This is the Theology Matters podcast. I'm your host, Josh Malden, and I'm here today with a co-host, Andrew Davison. And we are continuing our podcast series on systematic theology, its purposes, tasks, and goals. And we're here today with a special guest, Kevin Hector, who is the Naomi Shenstone Donnelly Professor of Theology and the Philosophy of Religions at the University of Chicago. He's the author of at least three books at this point, Theology Without Metaphysics being the first, and then the Theological Project of Modernism. And then the book we're here to speak about today is titled Christianity as a Way of Life, a Systematic Theology, and it's published by Yale University Press. And I should say, Andrew is the Starbridge Professor of Theology and Natural Sciences at Cambridge University and is also a visiting fellow at CTI for 2 years, including this current year. So we're looking forward, Kevin, to this conversation. We've been reading your book, really enjoying it. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I should say, thank you for doing this series on systematic theology. I've found it really helpful for my own thinking, but I'm also just, I'm happy about it for the sake of the field. So thank you.
And you have a Princetonian history, of course.
Yes, I do.
And maybe we can speak about that in a moment. But before we do, let me turn it over to Andrew for get you into the conversation here.
Well, I wanted to begin by talking about the big overarching theme of your book, which is the absolute centrality of practice to Christian theology and the idea that really you can't separate Christian belief from practice. And you could say that practices have propagated and shaped the faith, but you could probably say even more than that, that much of what Christians believe has been in response to the things that they do. So why do Christians worship Christ and the Holy Spirit? Well, because they hold them to be divine, but it actually goes in the opposite direction as well. How do we come to the idea that we talk about Christ or the Holy Spirit as God? Well, because we worship them. And similarly, in your book, you talk about baptism and some of the things that we say about living in a world that has a certain kind of infection of sinfulness, like a sinfulness that lies behind even before we do individual things, comes as a response to the practice of baptizing infants. So I think this theme of the absolute connection of belief and practice is central to your book, and it is indeed central to what Christianity is. And I wondered if you could maybe just begin by highlighting some of the practices that you think are absolutely central to being a Christian today, and how you would say that they teach and represent Christian theology.
That's a great question, and thank you for the, I think, really generous introduction to the book. So part of, if I can take a step back in order to answer the question, part of what motivated me to write the book, I mean, partly I wanted to try my hand at writing a more theological theology, and I wanted to try my hand at systematics, but I wanted to capture some of the way Christians, regular Christians I know, the way they express and inhabit and practice their devotion to Christ and what that looks like. And very often that includes beliefs, the sort of thing we would normally talk about as doctrines, but it also included things like it's really important to sing God's praises together, and it's really important to be praying, and really important to be trying to love people who might be difficult. And so some of those practices that end up at the heart of the book strike me as at the heart of a lot of people's sort of lived Christianity. So hopefully that gives you some sense of where I'm maybe coming from. But I do think practices like prayer is obviously really central. I think the practice of forgiveness is central. The practice of trying to love others is central. But I also think there are practices that are central even without people necessarily recognizing their centrality. Practices like imitation. Imitation strikes me as being a really important way that people learn to orient themselves toward Christ. And so I try to take that seriously as well.
I really like that discussion of imitation, and some of my own work has been on imitation of God. And I think that while we come at it from different perspectives, there would be a good conversation to be had there about exemplarity and that sort of thing. I want to cast my mind back to my own city, to Cambridge in the 1980s, and especially Emmanuel College and the Dean of Chapel there, Don Cupit. And there was a real sense then that Christianity was about practices. And this book and then television series called Sea of Faith and then a whole movement took that name. So I think that the difference is that they thought that there were practices instead of God. That really Christianity was only a set of human responses to being in the world, and there was basically no God. Whereas you have the emphasis similarly on practices, but God features pretty prominently in your book. Right. I wonder if you could reflect on similarities and differences, and what the influence of that movement has been, but also how theological history has developed since then.
Right, that's a great question. So, I mean, I will say just maybe dispositionally, but as a matter of principle as well, I find the world a puzzling place. I find almost everything I try to understand pretty puzzling, and so I'll take help wherever I can get it. And so while I don't agree with what I would think of as a kind of reductive approach to seeing Christianity in terms of practice, there's also a lot of insight that one can get from people who did take a more, what I think of as a kind of reductive approach. So I'm happy to learn from that stream of thought. And I think in some ways, I think of it, I don't think they thought of it, but I think of it as there is a kind of broader trend to resisting what might be thought of as a kind of overly intellectualized understanding of religion and of Christianity, and wanting to think about, well, what does lived Christianity really look like? And maybe we're distorting things by seeing it in just in terms of doctrines, for instance, if we are. And so from that perspective, it might look reductive to focus overly much on just doctrinal issues. As you say, though, my approach really tries to see these two things as hanging together. I think they're part of the same thing. If I'm trying to understand Christianity, Christians, by and large, do hold beliefs about God and about Jesus and about what Jesus has done to deliver us from sin, and about our sinfulness, and about the telos of all of this is. So I do think doctrine's actually really important, but I also want to say that it gets bound up with and expressed by practices in ways that are pretty fundamentally important also. And so I wanted to make sure I represented that if I'm trying to help people make sense of Christianity.
That seems completely right to me. And one of the things I so liked about your book was the sense that there was real common ground here. What one could take all sorts of different perspectives in terms of church tradition. One could put more emphasis on philosophy or less, or different kinds of philosophy. But there was something about the heart of Christianity here and its practice that people could all get behind, I think. One more question from me before I turn over to Josh, and I guess it's not just a question and more of an appreciation that there are two places in the book where you talk about not just caring about things, but caring that you care about them, not just being invested in some practice or stance in the world, but being invested in being invested in it. And that really struck home, and I thought it was fascinating. And I sort of want just to ask you to tell us a bit where that idea came from and where it features in your work. And partly it struck me because I think it's Daniel Dennett, the great critic of religion, wrote a couple of decades ago of his fellow Americans that he wasn't sure that they really believed in God, but they believed in believing in God. And you're saying something similar in a way that one needs to not just be invested, but being invested in being invested. I think also saying something quite different from him, but maybe this won't go anywhere, but I just wanted to land that as a bit of your book that I really appreciated, and invite you to tell us how it features in your thinking.
Yeah, I appreciate the appreciation. So as you can tell, I think with examples a lot. The thing I'm aiming for is understanding my own understanding, and then understanding that I could share with somebody, hopefully. There's a teacherly instinct that I have probably more basically than anything else. I started off as a high school teacher. I just am a teacher. And so that instinct to want to make sure I could explain things clearly in ways that people could get a grip on things, they could get it, they could move, you know, manipulate the concepts in ways that they couldn't before. That's what I'm always aiming for. And so when I'm trying to think about something like devotion, I try to think about, all right, so what are some examples of devotion? What do they have in common? And come up with an understanding based on that. Well, as I did that, I thought about things like devotion to marriage, right? So devotion to one's spouse, or devotion to a career. I said I was a teacher, and so I would see people who were devoted teachers. And one of the features that stood out to me was that in most cases, there wasn't just a real attention to or care for whatever it is that one cared about, but one's care for it itself mattered, right? So teaching matters to me, and it's mattering to me matters to me, such that if I noticed it was mattering less to me, I would worry. I would want to do things to make sure that it maintained its place in my evaluative perspective, because it's mattering to me matters to me. Same with my love for my wife. That matters to me in ways that I would want to make sure it continued to matter to me, right? And so, it was really a matter of trying to think about these things in connection with a range of examples that led me to think that that's a pretty important feature of how we care about things, especially if it's the kind of care that I talk about as devotion.
Hmm. I wonder whether that has something to say about one practice that features in the lives of some Christians, namely spiritual direction. Mm. If you find someone who periodically you talk about your life and faith with, then this question of what's mattering to me is important, and why is it mattering to me, and is it mattering more or less?
Yes, that is a great point. I like that point a lot, and I've been reading more and more in the monastic traditions, and that's not the only place where such spiritual direction features, but it does, right? And it's, there are all of these, there's from the outside, one thinks of monks often as sort of the superheroes of faith. And then one reads in these traditions, and it's the mundane things of recognizing how distractible we are and how easy it is to get caught up in things other than what we mean to be caught up in, and how really hard it is to persist in caring about Jesus, persist in caring about the thing that brought one to the monastery in the first place. And therefore, all of these practices that get built up around that, including, as you say, practices of spiritual direction. I think that's a really nice point, and it's a really nice illustration of what I was trying to get at. So thank you for that.
Well, I do a little bit of that as a priest and benefit it on the other side as well. So this business of meta-mattering will feature spiritual direction for me in the future. I'm going to pass over to Josh.
Even on... Just touching base on that point, I was interested, in Kevin, and glad you brought up your use of examples, because I thought that was, you know, a real treat throughout, and it reminded me of a lot of philosophical work, which, you know, often uses examples. I'm thinking, for example, of Robert Adams's Finite and Infinite Goods, which I kind of kept thinking about in some ways in reading this, and maybe speak a bit about how you know, are you constantly thinking of these examples to make your theological and philosophical points more clear? And the other thing that, and this is again a kind of point of just appreciation, as Andrew just said, I found myself actually reading it almost as a spiritual guide at times. Like, this is actually helping me think through how I, you know, for example, how I order my loves in the Augustinian sense, which you talk about how I order my loves for family and work and so on and so forth, in relation to God as the ultimate end. But maybe speak to all of that, and including how you kind of come at these from a somewhat of a philosophical perspective.
Yeah. So one of the things I've enjoyed about this series is how you think about theological style or the forms that theology takes. I found that really interesting, and you've got quite a range of styles represented. I think it's fair to say that the style of my book is very, just the style of my thinking. It's very plain. It's sort of workmanlike in the sense that it's not lovely. It sort of aims to get the job done, maybe. I would like to be able to write more lovely sentences, but I'm working on it. But the thing that probably stands out stylistically more than anything is my relentless use of examples. And partly that's because I'm aiming for understanding, and understanding, to my mind, especially if I'm trying to make understanding accessible to someone else, but also test whether I understand something, really involves being able to see the logic in things, how things are related to one another, and seeing an orderliness in the relationship of things, and being able to relate that to familiar sorts of phenomena, things that I already have a pretty good grip on, so that I can see the pattern in something familiar in something that's less familiar, and therefore get some clarity, get some kind of grasp of it. So I use lots and lots of examples. It is reminiscent of a certain style of analytic philosophy. You do me great honor to compare the book to Bob Adams' Finite and Infinite Goods, which is one of the books I most esteem. Because Adams is great at working through abstract concepts in connection with examples. Right? And so for me, it's hopefully a matter of helping readers, and really testing my own understanding, but helping readers get some kind of clarity about Christianity. And it's also part of what helps me think that I could write a book that would be of use to scholars who may or may not have any interest in this way of life in any first personal sense, and the regular Christians who I talked about at the outset today, where there are people who have written me from lots of different places who are, they're not specialists, they're not academics, they're just interested in, well, they're interested in devoting their lives to Christ. And so they hopefully can find something in this book that would help them with that. In the same way, though, because Christianity is a form of life meant to be devoted to Christ, shedding light on that can help someone who just wants to understand Christianity and has no interest in pursuing that way of life, such is my hope, at least. So the idea that you would find something illuminating, maybe spiritually illuminating about it, that warms my heart, and it's not beside the point of what I was trying to do.
You also have a really good, this is just off the cuff, but you have a really good discussion of Marilyn Robinson's novel Lila, which I think is another way of using examples, you know, using literature. And I read that book about 10 years ago when it came out, and I found your reading of it extremely illuminating. And it reminded me so much about the book. And in a sense, I've always thought that was sort of the darkest book of that series, although I haven't read Jack the most recent. But you really get into the ideas of shame and kind of sin and evil that are present there. Other examples I thought were, some of them are just, you know, interesting, funny even. You mentioned Breaking Bad, for example. You mentioned, you're talking about systematic bias and as a form of sin. And you mentioned that it requires a kind of power such that if you had an idiosyncratic bias against persons who drive a particular sort of car, like Nissan Altimas, you say, but it would only be in a very unlikely event that you ever had power over somebody who drove a Nissan Altima. So you have a really good way of illustrating the way in which power and bias have to kind of go together for this kind of systematic nature of sin to work out. But maybe speak to any of that, but also I'm curious if you could talk a bit about how your own location at the University of Chicago influenced your trajectory. And I'm thinking particular about the beginning of the book when you're wanting to talk about how theology has a place in the modern secular university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So let me say a little bit about the first half of the question and then a little more about the second half. Right. And I this picks up on something you asked earlier. I'm sort of always on the lookout for examples, or I'm always thinking about how different things connect. And there is something playful about that sensibility. And sometimes the playfulness comes across in the examples. They're not all lighthearted, but when I talk about Star Wars or when I talk about Kobe Bryant, those are really lighthearted examples, and they're meant to, in some ways, signal the kind of playfulness involved in seeing connections, I think. But with respect to my setting at the University of Chicago, it's a resolutely secular university that happens to have theology as one of its offerings. But I worry and have worried for a while about institutional support for theology. The institutions that are sort of happy homes for theology are increasingly drying up, at least academic versions of that. Universities like mine, there's not many of them, but they are there. It struck me that I needed to, or at least wanted to, make sure I was doing a theology that was faithful not only to the religious side of theology, but theology that could be recognizably faithful to the mission of a university, and that could be legible to central administrative committees as the sort of thing that they would want to credit as part of their university. And so what emerges is I think of it as very much a contextual theology, a theology that is trying to be faithful in a particular context. And in my context, the context of a secular academic university. And I believe that theology has something to contribute to a university like mine. But I needed to think really carefully about how to lay that out, partly because I want others to be able to do something similar. I think it's important that theology flourish not just in secular universities, but here too. And so I wanted, that's why there's something sort of fussy about that first chapter. But I really wanted to make it clear what the mission of a university like mine is, and therefore how theology could be recognizable as contributing to that mission.
Reading your book made me think that I'd written a bit on practices, on sacraments, I think, palliative care, mm-hmm. parish, and blessing. And I'm revising my book on blessing at the moment, second edition. It's a topical question in the life of the church. And there are a few places in your book that I will, you know, want to think about more as I do that rewriting. So you talk a lot about devotion as setting aside, which is, you know, could also be called a kind of form of consecration. And mm-hmm. We bless things, places, objects to consecrate them in that kind of way. There's a lovely description of the layering of meaning of material things and spaces. Mm. I think the blessing is both contributing to that, but also quite often recognizing this layering.
That's nice.
And then there's a couple of places where you discuss Jewish practices of blessings, where mm-hmm. one greets parts of the day, different encounters, stages of the year, with a blessing. And you say that it means that nothing is taken for granted and everything is received as a gift. So I don't know much about your confessional background and church practice. It may be one where blessings feature a lot and maybe they don't, but I wondered if there had been any times when you've come across the blessing of places, people, things, endeavors, and how that might fit with your theology.
Yeah, I actually thought about blessings coming into this conversation for two reasons. One, because of your work, which I really appreciate. And two, because I've different parts of the book have grown in my imagination since writing it. I had to make a lot of difficult choices about what things to include and not include. And so you get some representative practices, but far and away not the entire slate of practices that are worth discussing. And I talk about blessing, but I talk about it pretty quickly. And it strikes me that practice of blessing, the kind of thing you're talking about, where it's not, where it includes things like blessing before meals, but also there are Christian practices of blessing animals and blessing homes and blessing people and blessing particular days, right? It's actually a really important practice. And it's the kind of thing the book I'm working on now focuses on the theological virtues. But it's the kind of thing that I want to talk more about under the rubric of faith. Because it definitely plays an important role in the way people have more and more of the world taken up into this orientation toward God. And so, yeah, it's something that I wish I had expanded on or could have expanded on. I'm heartened to know that you've already done most of the good work there. But I think that's such an important practice, and I'm pleased that you bring it up. I would welcome you to say more. It is your podcast.
Well, I look forward to reading that book on the theological virtues, and your book will feature in the revised edition of the Blessing Book. One of the things I'm struck at in my own church, Church of England, when people are talking about this, is the official line seems to be, we don't bless things, we don't bless places, we don't bless endeavors or relationships, we just bless people. And I think that A, is just not accurate. I mean, that is not the practice of the church, and it's not even the practice of the liturgy of the church. But I also just think they're missing something. It's, to use a word you used earlier, reductive. Mm. It's also to give places, things, matter, somehow over to this realm that's outside of the holy. Mm-hmm. So I'll certainly be drawing on that reference to matter and place and space in your book.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And right. I mean, I think you're exactly right that the endeavor should be, yes, of course, bless people, but bring more and more, not just people, right? It's not as if, as you say, it's not just people who can be consecrated, can be devoted to God, right? That what would it mean if we blessed careers so that people didn't just see their careers as something outside of that which is set apart for God? But that too is, it comes under God's blessing. That too is consecrated and set apart. I think we should be aiming for more and more to be included in blessings rather than just arbitrarily almost limiting blessing to the blessing of people, recognizing that too is a really important thing that needs to be blessed.
Oh, well, I'd love to talk about that more, but I'm going to move on to another question. I think many of our listeners are somewhat familiar with theology and recent theological history and who's writing what, but not everyone will be. And even the ones who spend their whole lives in academic theology, there'll be plenty that they're not aware of. So I think one of the things this podcast can do is give people tips and like tip-offs, as it were, about what's exciting, what's worth reading, what's happening, what theology looks like this year, at this moment. And so I wondered if anything springs to mind, that things both that have influenced you, but also that you think people with the kind of interest to listen to this podcast would benefit from.
What a fun question. So, all right. I'll give you a hot tip. I am increasingly convinced that memoir is a really important site of constructive theology. And thinking about the way people navigate religious inheritances in order to help them navigate their circumstances, and the way that therefore trying to lead a life and drawing on one's religion to help one do that involves a kind of rethinking of that tradition, whatever it is. That strikes me as one of the most interesting places where theology is being done today. And it's being made explicit in the form of memoir, and therefore it's a place where we can find it, but it's something that it doesn't, I think it goes in and out of fashion in the world of sort of official theology. But I increasingly think, especially given certain cultural trends, it strikes me as a more and more important place where theology is going to be done. I can give some suggestions along these lines if you'd like.
Please do. We've already mentioned Marilynne Robinson and her novels. And for me, the greatness of those novels is they show the plausibility of a Christian view of the world from the inside in a fictionalized way, although I'm sure drawing her own experience. And so I think there's a real parallel there between what she's doing in those novels and what a reflective memoir would do. But please spill the beans on.
Right. I mean, so some of these will be familiar, but I think good examples of what I have in mind, Mary Carr's Lit is a paradigmatic memoir, but it's also a really interesting account of how Mary Carr navigates faith in order to help her deal with alcoholism, and how there has to be a reshaping of her faith in order for it to sort of do the trick. But we see something similar in Charles Marsh's Evangelical Anxiety and Christian Wyman's Zero with the Bone, as well as his earlier memoir, My Bright Abyss. We see it in Lauren Winner's memoirs. We see it. Actually, one that I've especially enjoyed recently, Khusru Nayyari's Everything Sad is Untrue, which is a really gangbusters. You talk about theological style. It's a really unusual style, really propulsive and fun, but deeply theological and really trying to think through what does it look like for especially his mother to live out this faith in the face of abuse, in the face of being pursued by an oppressive regime. What does it look like to be in a refugee camp for a year? And what does faith look like in a refugee camp for a year when there seems to be no hope on the horizon? All of these are really gripping and really powerful memoirs in their own right. And there's something really profoundly theological going on there.
I hope there might be some publishers listening to this and spark in their mind that this is a good thing to include in their list.
Here's hoping.
It's interesting that Augustine's Confessions is one of the most read theology books, you know, of all time, and it's a memoir.
Yep. And so another example, Natalie Carnes has a book modeled on the Confessions. It's called Motherhood, a Confession, I believe. And it's a brilliant book in its own right. And it's a really clear example of the kind of thing I'm talking about, where in order to help her make sense of and navigate her circumstances, especially this circumstance of being a mother, where you come to terms with being a mother, and that means having yourself outside of yourself. And then you have to come to terms with this part of you that's outside of you separating from you increasingly, right? And the way she does a creative rereading of Augustine's Confessions in order to help her navigate her own confessions, it's just brilliant. And it's just the kind of thing that I feel like it's, again, I can't help reading that and thinking this is one of the places where the most interesting theology is being done. And I want to think about what it means to be attentive to that as a theologian.
Makes me think of Vittorio Montemaggi, a great Dante scholar, who wrote an absolute blockbuster of a book on Dante and theology a couple of years ago. And it's really autobiographical. It's completely genre busting. And so that would be an example of basically a work of theology, but that is dissolving into memoir from that side. Where are these books that you put them in the memoir part of a publisher's list, but full of theology.
Yeah, so we usually end, Kevin, with a few sort of short questions, and I'll just go straight for them. What's the one book that influenced your theology the most?
Truthfully, probably the Bible, but if I am going beyond that, I think there are figures who have a seat at my table for every single thing that I'm trying to think about. And that I think about that more than I think about single books. So I can name them if you want, but it's probably not a single book beyond the Bible.
Sure. Well, you can. Yeah. Name them.
So you could probably tell, right? But Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, Luther, Calvin, Schleiermacher, Bart, James Cone, Gustavo Gutierrez, Rosemary Radford Ruther. And then also figures like Julian of Norwich is always haunting me. Simone Weil is always haunting me. I don't go to them topic by topic so much as always try to think about their witness and what it means to be true to the kind of witness they hold before me.
And what book of theology would you recommend to a beginner interested in the topic?
I think the first systematic theology book that really lit a fire for me was Kathy Tanner's Jesus, Humanity, and the Trinity. It's so brief, but so just dripping with insight and new ways of seeing things that it's just a really exciting, fun to me book.
There are no right and wrong answers to that question, but that is a great answer.
Thank you.
And what are you reading right now? What's on the nightstand?
So right now I'm reading a lot of theologies of education, including sort of Willie Jennings, Carrie Day, Mark Jordan. There's that great series that Ted Smith put together, but also Merton has some interesting stuff to say, bell hooks. So I'm reading a lot of that stuff. And then beyond that, a lot of work, a lot of memoirs and a lot of work on this book on theological virtues, which is fundamentally a book that's trying to think about what it means to be true to or be a resource to, at least, the theology I see in memoirs.
Well, Kevin Hector, we really want to thank you for being on the podcast and for undertaking this really enjoyable, interesting conversation, and for your book, Christianity as a Way of Life, A Systematic Theology, which we highly recommend to anyone interested. So thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be here. And thank you again, not only for inviting me, but also for this ministry that you all have kept up. I think it's, as I said, it's good for the field. And so I'm grateful for that, as well as the chance to be part of it.
Thanks.